Hey, everybody. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Risa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, he's a former high school English teacher turned lawyer who now represents the Sacramento suburbs and Sierra foothills in the state assembly.
That's right. He's Republican Kevin Kiley, a lawyer who once worked in Kamala Harris's Department of Justice. Although he's kind of quick to say he never met her, we'll ask him about that. Assemblyman Kiley joins us in a few minutes. But first, Marisa, pretty big day in Sacramento. Governor Newsom unveiling his revised budget, very different from the one he unveiled in January, takes into account the harsh realities of COVID-19, shaving $19 billion off the budget he released back then. Our Sacramento politics reporter, Katie Orr, was in the room for the budget presentation today. And Katie, good to have you with us. Before we start, though, I want to hear what it was like to be there, because this was the first in-person press conference with reporters there since mid-March. What was it like?
Yeah, it was not like anything I've ever been to before in terms of a budget announcement or a May revise. It was at the Secretary of State's office. He has a large auditorium there. The press was limited to about 10 reporters. I had my temperature checked before I went in. They had assigned seats so that we were like very socially distant from each other.
What was your temperature?
They didn't tell me. They just told me it was apparently it didn't raise any red flags.
Okay.
And I also had to wear a mask, which didn't work out great with my glasses. But it was a very much more controlled environment. They were trying to strike a balance between letting reporters have access to the governor during this, you know, tumultuous time, but also keeping people safe.
Well, let's talk about the budget. As I said, it shaves $19 billion off of the budget. Most of the problem, of course, from the cratering revenue. What was the tone that the governor set, and what are some of the big takeaways?
Well, the tone was that I took away from it, really, was that the federal government needs to step up. He said it time and time again that we are facing a massive budget deficit, $54 billion over the next 2 years. And even if the state makes all the cuts in the coming years, there will still be issues. He said this is not something that California alone can handle, that the state needs, the federal government really needs to kick in more money. Specifically, he was backing a plan from Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi to give more money to state and local governments.
Yeah, that's a $3 trillion plan. I know that the governor and other governors around the country have asked for $1 trillion for state and local governments, Katie. And again, thank you for taking one for the team and going to that. You know, education was something that we were all watching to see kind of how things went there. And it does seem like he is attempting to cushion the blow. He said that the shortfall is pegged at $19 billion and that they've found a kind of mix of ways to cushion that. So it's closer to $10 billion, I think, now. Some of that does include federal money that's already been appropriated. Some of that includes what I think our guest might call kicking the can down the road around pensions. You know, this idea that the state is going to take money that they would have put towards longer-term pension liabilities and help school districts with their annual pension liabilities over the next 2 years. Do you think that's going to be a big sticking point in Sacramento?
Well, I think we're seeing Newsom trying to make the best out of a bad situation, right? I mean, certainly when you come to pension obligations, that's always an area of contention among lawmakers. Is the state paying too much? How can we reduce our obligation? While others say, you know, this is something that civil servants really work for and deserve. So you're trying to see Newsom give the teachers something to help them through this dark time. But, you know, I think everyone has to acknowledge that this is the first of a couple of years of potential budget cuts that we're looking at. And as you said, he's trying to soften the blow, but I don't know how long that can go on for.
And Katie, of course, in January, the governor rolled out some big, ambitious programs around housing, homelessness, a number of issues, childcare. Is it fair to assume those are just all out the window now?
He said in his press conference today that the majority of the new things that he had proposed are gone. The state simply doesn't have the money to pay for those right now. And as I said, and as you've heard, Scott, too, that people aren't even as concerned about this year as they are about the coming budget years, because at least now they assume that the federal government will hopefully reimburse us for things like through FEMA, stuff like that. And they're not sure what's going to happen in the coming years when they don't have those reimbursements coming in, but the tax revenues and all of that is still depressed.
Katie, you know, I think that this is going to be a very different situation than we've seen since Newsom came into office, right? We had this massive expansion. And I think that it does seem like he is trying, you know, to cushion a lot of this, as I said before, as much as possible. But one of the big expansions in his January budget was, of course, Medi-Cal coverage to undocumented seniors. Can you talk about that? And that, I mean, obviously that's being canceled, but the sort of framing he put around this, because it's sort of this dichotomy, right? At the same time as we're spending more than ever on a lot of these new things that weren't even our lexicon before, like PPE, right, and ventilators, they're being asked to cut. So can you talk about how he kind of framed the healthcare aspect of all this?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you want to, there are certain programs that you can address to save like actual dollars in the budget, but you have to look at the overall picture of how, of like in the long run, what is this going to do to the health and safety of, you know, people in the state? Is this cut now going to mean we're going to have to pay more down the road for people, you know, when they get sick because we didn't give them insurance right now because we couldn't afford to do it? It's, you know, he always says like, well, he says we're not playing small ball here. And I feel like that is something that really applies here, because you're talking about impact to millions of people for years to come. And that's something they really have to weigh, both the governor and the legislature, when they decide what gets cut and what gets funded in these budgets in the coming years.
And Katie, I spoke to Senator Holly Mitchell earlier today. She ran for the legislature back in 2010, I think it was, because she didn't like the way the legislature was dealing with the budget deficit back then. And she was an advocate for, you know, childcare and other low-income family benefits. And she said that one of the things they learned last time was that you want to make smart cuts. You don't want to make cuts that you can't undo as the, you know, the economy recovers, as the pandemic goes away. Hopefully it will. Did you get any sense of those lessons being applied by the governor when he rolled out the budget today, in terms of, you know, not eliminating things, but maybe reducing them or freezing them?
Yeah, I think we did get a sense of that, but actually more so in the past budget that he already passed. He said that a lot of the ongoing spending, he said a lot of the spending that had been added in the previous budget was one-time spending. And that is something that he really emphasized last year, that these are one-time funds. We don't want ongoing spending just because of this very situation, where if you put in a lot of new ongoing spending, then that might have to be cut when we hit a recession. And last year, though, we certainly didn't anticipate anything like COVID-19. There was concern that a recession was on the horizon. We had been overdue for one, and they were very cognizant of that while crafting the budget. So I think that is a lesson that they did take from past financial downturns, you know, more one-time spending, less ongoing spending where they can make it work.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, we do have pretty significant rainy day funds compared to where we were when I was covering the 2009 crash. Katie, before we let you go, talk us through what's happening next. I mean, I can't imagine that even though they have to pass and, you know, he must sign a balanced budget by July 1st, that will be the end of the conversation around next year's budget, or certainly the one after that.
You know, that's really interesting, because I actually asked the governor that question at his press conference today. Does he anticipate coming back in August after we have the July 15th tax revenues, so we actually know the amount of money we're going to be working with, not just projections, and redo the budget process? So far, the answer from the governor's office, he did not answer it directly in the press conference, but the answer I got from his office was no. To them, they think that this, what they have crafted, should get us through to July, and then it should hold up for the rest of the year. They're not like sticking to that. You know, they're not going to, you know, that's not their hill to die on, but they're saying that that is their plan. Whereas we have heard from people in the legislature saying that, no, you know, maybe we'll just do something temporarily and, you know, till July and then come back in August and really pass a fuller budget then. So I think it'll be interesting. It's kind of setting up a possible disagreement between the legislature and the governor's office about how they exactly want to address this issue. But as you mentioned, they have to pass something by June 15th. Just how complete and robust it is remains to be seen.
Yeah, we'll surely be back after that to be taking up some of the other issues that they didn't have time to deal with this time. So Katie Orr, thank you so much. We'll say goodbye to you for now. And we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Republican Assemblyman Kevin Kiley. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And our guest today is the man who represents the northern suburbs around Sacramento up to the Sierra foothills in El Dorado County. Kevin Kiley, welcome to the Breakdown.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, listen, you've been listening to us chatting about the budget, but what's your reaction? I'm sure you were paying attention to the governor today. What do you think of what he rolled out?
Yeah, so I listened to the press conference. I should say, you know, I haven't had the chance to study it in great detail yet. But kind of my, you know, initial response is that unfortunately, it continues to bear, the mark of what's really hobbled a lot of our state's economic response to the pandemic. And that's, you know, the one of the defining characteristics of California politics in general, the influence of special interest groups. You know, you see that $20 million are still allocated in this budget, which the governor says is for our most essential priorities. We have $20 million to enforce AB 5 and go after independent contractors in the state of California in order to benefit the state's biggest and wealthiest interest group. And then, you know, at the same time, we're going to have dramatically reduced funding, of course, for local governments, for school districts all across the state. And what I'd like to see is the legislature and the governor softening that blow by trying to reduce at the same time some of the state imposed costs on these entities. So let's take away some of the mandates on local school districts or the compliance burdens for cities and counties. And for that matter, get rid of a lot of the excessive regulations on small businesses so that they can survive and get back on their feet. And ultimately, they'll contribute tax revenue as well.
Assemblyman, I want to go back to the first thing you mentioned, which is AB 5. This is the law passed last year that requires a lot of independent contractors to become employees. I know this has been a big bee in your bonnet. This is not a thing you like. I'm just curious, though, is that really the most important thing that you're looking at? We're talking $20 million here. And I mean, as you know, independent contractors don't qualify for employee benefits and things like that. I mean, just given the discussion we were just having about trade-offs, is that really going to make that big of a difference?
Well, I bring that up initially just as sort of it's symbolic, I think, of the general approach that somehow that $20 million still found its way into this thing. And it shows you who's really driving the process. But to answer your question more broadly, I think
let me just interrupt you real quick. When you say who's driving, you mean you're talking about labor?
Yeah, or the big union conglomerates. I mean, I don't even really call them labor because it's, you know, it's very different than what most people think of as a traditional labor union. These are more corporate-like entities. I will say that at a time in which folks need all the opportunities for work that they can get, the fact that we are by law prohibiting many people in several hundred professions from practicing their craft, and a lot of times these are manners of working that you can do from home at a time when people are forced to be in their homes, yet we're saying we're legally prohibiting people from doing that. I think that absolutely it's a very important issue at this point in time, and it's unfortunately exacerbated the negative impacts of the pandemic and the other forms of economic shutdown we've had.
And of course, the governor is heavily relying on, counting on, I won't say begging, but urging the federal government to step forward with another big package of stimulus. He's pushing and supporting Nancy Pelosi's call for another $3 trillion, including $900 million to states. What do you feel about that reliance on that federal money? Is that something you would encourage Republicans in Congress to support?
Yeah, sure. I mean, of course, in some form, we will take the relief if we can get it. But I don't think it should come to California just as sort of you know, a blank check. I think that there needs to be some assurance that the funding isn't going to be used in a way that only serves to enrich special interest groups and doesn't actually help out ordinary Californians. And when you look at the way our budget has grown, you know, if you look at what the governor had proposed at the beginning of this year, it's about $100 billion more than it was just a decade ago. And yet you look at where that money's going, things like, you know, health and education and social services, you don't see any corresponding improvement in the social conditions that spending is directed at. And so I think that, you know, that needs to be a big part of this conversation, is as we decide where we need to cut, and as we, you know, ask the federal government for assistance to avoid some of those cuts, there really needs to be a hard look at how much of the budget that we have now is actually advancing the public interest and doing the sort of things government's supposed to do.
Well, I would love to get your take on one of those areas, because you've been in the classroom before. That's, of course, education. And we mentioned, you know, that those folks are looking at the schools were looking at a $19 billion deficit. Newsom seems to have moved money around and is now proposing that closer to $9 or $10 billion. What's your take on that? Like, having been in classrooms, given this moment that we're trying to figure out distance learning with COVID-19, the possibility that we can't put the same amount of kids back in classrooms, you know, many local school districts were already underfunded. How do you think the legislature, I mean, what are you going to be advocating for around that?
Well, the funding issue is going to be a huge problem. There's no denying that. And, you know, districts already faced enormous cost pressures on a lot of fronts, from declining enrollment, from, of course, the pension situation, special education. And, you know, that was before COVID. And so a lot of them are really going to be struggling. And yeah, we do need to find a way to make sure they have the resources they need to keep, you know, and to adapt to the change environment and to be able to serve students. At the same time, you know, I think it's important to provide, and I've heard this from many, many district leaders, to provide a greater degree of flexibility for local districts in order to run the schools in their area as they see fit, because the state drives up their costs in a lot of ways with mandates and compliance burdens. And so if we can provide a little relaxation of that, then that'll actually help in a lot of ways, you know, in a way that that even more so than funding.
If you're just joining us, I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. You're listening to Political Breakdown. We're talking today with Kevin Kiley. He's the Republican Assemblyman who represents parts of Sacramento and El Dorado counties in the state legislature. And Assemblyman, as I mentioned, El Dorado, that's where the governor was yesterday when he announced some funding and preparation for the wildfire season. And El Dorado is one of those counties that was really quick to push for a faster reopening of its economy. The governor now has given, you know, I guess they've come to an agreement on how that's going to happen. He said today that 19 counties total, I think, have self-certified that they are prepared to do that and taking the steps to keep workers and customers safe and that sort of thing. Are you satisfied? How satisfied are you that you know, the state government is working collaboratively with counties like El Dorado?
It was a step in the right direction when he came up with this regional variance idea. And, you know, just by way of background, I was the first and most vocal supporter of the governor's initial stay-at-home order. On the last day before the legislature adjourned, I spoke in favor of the appropriation bill that we had and asked all Californians, regardless of political preference, to trust in the governor's leadership. So I've been, you know, someone who has been an advocate for strong action in terms of advancing public health and combating the pandemic. But as time went by and the restrictions remained the exact same throughout an entire diverse state of 40 million people, it became clear that that approach didn't make a whole lot of sense. So I was not one of those people, by the way, who was saying, well, every county should just be able to go its own way. What I proposed is more or less what the governor eventually landed on, which is that the state ought to be coordinating the process rather than dictating it, rather than controlling it. So the state can still set out criteria that individual counties or localities need to satisfy, and then it's up to them to show that they have. So I was really happy that Placer, which I also represent, and El Dorado County, were able to meet those and have now moved to a somewhat more accelerated timeline. I also represent the city of Folsom, which is within Sacramento County, which is kind of being hamstrung by the general numbers for a very large county of Sacramento. So what I'd actually like to see is the approach get a little more granular and giving give a city like Folsom, or I also present communities of Orangevale and Fair Oaks the ability to maybe accelerate and move ahead to a different timeline than the rest of the county.
That seems like that could be challenging, though, right? Because people don't necessarily stick to work and play in their city. I mean, even the county by county thing has its own challenges. But I want to ask you about, you know, your statement saying, you know, that you were behind the governor. And I think we really did see an unusual amount of coming together, bipartisan togetherness in the early days of this. In a moment, I think we want to talk about the legislature's role. But I'm curious, like, what your take is, because it feels like this entire pandemic has become very politicized. We saw a poll this week showing really such a gap in the partisan divide about how worried people are about this, that Republicans were far, far less worried than Democrats about getting sick or their family members. What do you make of that? And are you worried that it could hamstring our efforts at recovery, both here and nationally?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think that, you know, you're right, that it is, it has been odd to see the way that kind of polling has played out a little bit. But, you know, at the same time, I think that there are, in our state, a lot of folks who kind of went into this whole thing not necessarily trusting our government, and frankly, with good reason, because I think that for a long time, the legislation we've gotten out of Sacramento has not been closely aligned with what's in the best interests of a lot of people in our state, and AB 5 is, you know, a leading example of that. So I do think that you know, when you have these very severe restrictions in place, and you have these kind of pre-existing issues of trust, then maybe that's where a lot of that plays out. Which is, by the way, one of the reasons I felt it important for me as someone who's part of the minority party to be extremely outspoken in on the importance of abiding by social distancing guidelines and the you know, the necessity of the stay-at-home order, because I felt like that was a way that I could try to you know, play a leadership role in helping folks understand that this is in no way, shape, or form a partisan issue, but is a vital issue of public health that affects us all.
As you know, at the beginning of this, the legislature, without a single nay vote, granted the governor $1.1 billion and said, you know, spend it the way you think is the best way for PPEs and that sort of thing. And then since then, there have been a lot of questions about the vetting of some of the companies that the state tried to contract with, some N95 masks not being authorized and approved. What are your thoughts about the job the legislature is doing or needs to do in terms of oversight and the fact that they, you know, basically wrote that check and left town?
That's, you know, you almost took the words out of my mouth. I've been quite critical of the way the legislature has engaged in this process, and there's been a real lack of leadership. And what's resulted is this, you know, regimen of one man rule, essentially. Or I've compiled all the executive orders the governor has issued. I think it's up to 38, where he's changed unilaterally something like 180 laws on his own. And frankly, in several cases, I think vastly overstepping his emergency powers, but the legislature has just let it happen. And there was no effort until the very end of the time we were recessed to even establish any sort of remote forum for legislators to engage. So I think that, you know, there's been two sides to blame here. On the one hand, there's been some overreach on the part of the governor. But then on the other hand, there's been an abdication of responsibility by the legislature.
We often talk a lot about people's biographies on the show. We kind of sloughed that off a little, Assemblymember, because of the budget news. But, you know, we mentioned at the top that you worked, we talked about you worked as a teacher. You were also in the state attorney general's office. I'm just curious what it's been like going from, you know, being a non-political, you know, you were not a political appointee under Kamala Harris, but working under a state government that has been dominated by Democrats and moving over to the legislature. Do you think you bring a different perspective because of that experience?
Maybe a little bit, but you know, my role at the Attorney General's office was decidedly non-political. As a matter of fact, it's forbidden by law for them to consider your political affiliation in hiring. You know, I was a civil servant. Mm-hmm. I was part of a vast bureaucracy as a deputy attorney general, and my job was to prosecute criminal cases that came up. There were felonies that came up on direct appeal. So It has actually, you know, given me maybe a little just a general sense of kind of how the government works at that level. But the, you know, the Kamala Harris thing, this has repeatedly come up in my campaigns, and I've, you know, been superimposed standing next to her on hundreds of thousands of mail pieces, TV commercials, and social media. I've never met her in my life. And, you know, you have people who work in the AG's office as prosecutors through 6-7 different attorney generals over 30 years. So
right, there's thousands of them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's thousands of people. So it's, you know, that's politics. What are you going to do? It's a very different role than being in the role of, as a legislator, which is, of course, a decidedly political job.
Yeah, I was just reflecting, though. So were you part, I mean, as a teacher, I don't know if you were part of the teachers union or in a union at the attorney general's office?
So when I was a teacher, I would opt out of the portion of the paycheck that goes of your dues that go to political activities. But at that point, the U.S. Supreme Court hadn't issued the Janus decision. So there was no ability to opt out of your more general dues. And that would also be the case for the time I was at the AG's office.
Well, we're almost out of time, but before we let you go, you represent a very outdoorsy kind of district. What are some of your favorite things to do out there in the foothills?
Oh, gosh, there's a lot of great hiking,
My Not now, though. Office, you have to socially distance, right?
Well, that's right. Well, so Folsom Lake, you can still hike to it, but the parking lot's closed. So that's actually one of the issues that we're dealing with because the voters aren't happy about that. But, you know, we've got a lot of beautiful hiking and biking trails. And if you're a golfer, we got great golf courses out here. If you're a top golfer, there's a Top Golf in Roseville, which sort of became the top landmark, in a sense, in our district when it opened a few years ago. We also just have some amazing communities. The two biggest cities I represent, Roseville and Folsom, Rockland, Lincoln, tremendous small businesses and, the communities that really have a lot to offer. So a lot of people stop by on your way to Tahoe or wherever the case may be. But once we move past the time we're in now, I hope you'll come visit sometime.
All right. Well, Assemblyman Kevin Kiley, thanks so much for joining us. Please give my apologies to the people of Placer County. I sort of erased them from your district at the top there, but they are
That's
very
actually
much
most of the district. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You bet. That's it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer today is Jim Bennett. KQED's leadership team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Jonathan Blakely, and Erica Aguilar. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter. I am at MLagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer. We'll see you next time. Stay healthy, everybody.